Time I saw our speaker, she was smiling, and she's been smiling ever since. And I think she has one of the warmest smiles that I've ever seen in my life. And the minute I saw her, I knew that she would be a friend for life. I'm really anxious to hear what she has to say, so I'd like to introduce Juanita P. from Roanoke, Virginia.
I might have to raise this a little bit. I'm the tallest one they've had up here yet. So. Instead of speaking this morning, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to tell you for 45 minutes how much I have enjoyed this conference. I really would. I'll start with the ice cream, which we're going to take a lot of it back to Virginia with us today, and the singing and the fellowship last night was something that I have never experienced in my life like I did last night. The other thing that I have just never had so much fun at an airline conference was the skits and the jokes, and I think we've got some professionals in our midst. I really do. Those gals and guys last night were great, and I know from some of the work that we've done in Roanoke on skits and things how much goes into preparing that and how much work behind the scenes there is, and how they don't just get up here and do these things that we all enjoy so much, and it gives us so much laughter. And I'm really grateful for all the people and the time that they spent getting all of that fun ready last night. And I could just go on and on about that. But God brought me to West Virginia, and the big book tells me that when I speak, that I'm to tell in a general way what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And that's what I'm going to do this morning, and I hope that something I say helps y'all. But if nothing else, I know it'll help me, because it helps me to go back and to remember what it was like and how I used to live and how a power greater than myself brought me here and could actually help me to be honest enough to tell somebody else what it used to be like, because I never told anybody anything honest in my life. I avoided telling the truth at any cost. And that contributed a lot to my illness and to the illness of my family, too. I was born and raised in Covington, Virginia. There's a big West Vaco there. Y'all probably know what I'm talking about. And I lived there until we moved to Roanoke. I'm the oldest of two daughters. And I've been around alcoholism my whole life. My father is an alcoholic. He's been sober for a number of years. And he was always the biggest influence in my life. I patterned so much of myself after Daddy. He really did carry a lot of influence in my life. I have a younger sister, about 15 months younger than I am. And as far as I know, she's never been attracted to alcoholics. I don't know where we differed in that, but I sure was. As far back as I can remember, I can see myself as a phony and as a liar, and as insecure. I have always been so insecure. I grew up wanting Daddy to love me more than he loved Mother or my sister. And a lot of the things that I did, a lot of the trouble I got into, was because I was trying to make him love me more. Because if I did something, and I usually was doing something, he would catch me at it, but he paid attention to me. Now, that's negative attention. I was punished or grounded or whatever, but I wanted him so much to love me more than them. And I was very competitive with my sister and my mother. I always just set my mind to do anything I did better than either one of them could do. I wanted to be a better mother, a better wife. Anything that they did, I did better. And I can see now where I did a lot of damage to my sister that way because I was so overbearing. I had such an overbearing personality. I was usually in trouble. I grew up fighting and about 10 years ahead of myself. And they had a time with me. I'd steal Daddy's car at night when he didn't know I had it. Well, of course, that's stealing if you take something nobody knows you have it. I dated boys that he didn't like, most of them that drank, because that was something I was always comfortable with, was that type of personality. I belonged with an alcoholic. That's what I knew. That's what I grew up with. That's where I felt like I belonged, was with that type of personality. And they always had more fun than the rest of the people seemed to have. And they wanted to do some of the things I wanted to do. So it seemed like I always stayed hooked up with someone who drank too much. And to this day, I still find the alcoholic is such a warm and giving person. And I see now why many of the reasons I was attracted to an alcoholic are not all bad reasons either. I started in high school when I was 13, and I was this size when I was 13. I haven't grown a bit. Except maybe this way. And that just increased this terrible insecurity that I had. I was so big, and everybody else, you know, was so small, and I was developed, and of course older boys noticed me, and Daddy had, you know, words about that, but I thought that was great, you know. And I had a real time in high school because I was so big, and I had such a complex about that. And that was one of the reasons I was always attracted to older men, was because they were big enough. You know, the fellas my age just hadn't finished growing yet, you know. And I hated the idea of being with somebody who was littler than me. That really made the insecurity worse. So I met a boy in high school. I was just starting and he was just finishing. He was 19. And my father had drank with his father. And needless to say, he didn't like him because he knew the daddy. And that just made me that much more determined that I was going to go with that boy. And we dated off and on all the way through high school. And I never had a secure relationship with any man I ever went with. I was always doing the same thing that I did with my father's. I wanted somebody to love me more than anything else, more than liquor, more than anything, more than his car, whatever. And so I always had insecure relationships with the men I knew because they were founded on insecurity. A person who doesn't feel that they're worthy of a relationship can hardly develop one with somebody. Well, we had a stormy time, and he went off to Vietnam. He flunked out of college, and my father was delighted. So 3,000 miles, or 10,000 miles, to, you know, was a lot of separation. And I dated off and on while he was gone and was really heartbroken. And he had another girlfriend all the time that we were going together. She was his age. So he had me, who was 5 years younger, and her, who was his age. And I remember writing him a letter when he was in Vietnam, and I said, why don't you go ahead and make up your mind on who you're going to come home to, you know, me or her? Because I don't see no sense in wasting my time waiting on you if you ain't going to come home to me. And so he wrote me back and told me not to waste any more time. So he wasn't coming home to me. And I think right there is where I had a severe personality change. I really did everything I had counted on. Because, see, I'm from a small town. And it was humiliating to think that this boy that I'd been with all those years was not going to come home and marry me. And, you know, once you start going with somebody in a small town, you're his girl. You know, and there wasn't nobody else that would come around, you know. So I thought, boy, you know, my life is just about over with. And that's when I met my first husband. Well, I meant to tell y'all, my daddy was born in West Virginia over at Sherwood Lake. And my first husband's from West Virginia. He was from Raynell. So I've been around West Virginia. Did I do that? I've been around West Virginia a long, long time. Been all around this country and love it. Really do. This is the first time I've been back in a long time. But this was this summer after this boy had gone off to Vietnam. I met my first husband. He was from West Virginia. He was over there working at the paper mill. He was a good bit older than I was because he was tall, tall enough, and making good money and drinking and had his own car. And God, I loved him. Oh, just as soon as I saw him. And my sister introduced us. And we dated off and on all that rest of my senior year and got engaged and I decided we'd get married. Bless his heart, he didn't really think that was the end that he was looking for, but I was determined that we were going to get married. And we had a lot of fights and not calling him any names, but he was into alcoholism when I met him. He had weekend blackouts. He was 21 at that time. I was 17. And he would be gone for days, and I wouldn't know where he was. Be drinking and gone, and wouldn't know where he'd been. And you know, but I thought, as soon as I marry him, we'll straighten all of that out, won't we? But I didn't. I didn't. And I guess we were kind of doomed from the start, like Walt said last night with his first marriage. We were two kids who were mad and hurt and angry, and all we did was take it out on each other. I hurt him, and he hurt me, and we spent 5 years of the most heartbreaking anguish that I have ever experienced in my life. I mean, we fought day and night, off and on for 5 years. In that time, we had two precious little girls that have really saved my sanity, that I just owe so much to. And really, if I had to go through that to have them, I'm grateful because they mean so much to me today. We finally got to the point where he didn't much care if he saw me, and I knew I didn't care if I saw him. And we decided that, it was time to call quit to it. So he moved out, and we got a divorce and sold a home, and I took the two children and bought a little house in town and went to work. And I thought, well, heck, this is a good time to catch up on all the fun that I missed while I was married to him. So I started dating and again fell into the same pattern of looking for a man that loved me more than anything else. And I looked and I looked and I looked, and it was at this time that I met my second husband. And my sister introduced us. I'm going to stay away from her when she has any more men. I'm going to make sure that she introduces them to somebody else, because I'm not well enough to meet another one. I'm really not. But she introduced us, and believe it or not, he was drunk. Tall and good looking. Oh, he is so good. And drunk. Just out of his mind. You know? But as soon as I saw him, this is what I said when I saw him, because he was married at that time. I asked my sister, I said, does he have a bigger brother? And she said, no, I'm sorry, he's the only boy in the family. And I said, well, you take what you can get. I tell you. So during this time when I was going through a divorce, his marriage was on the rocks too. He was married and they had a little girl. And they lived close to my sister. That's how I did meet him. And once I moved into my little house, he started calling and coming around. And I said, listen, I just got out of one mess, friend. I don't want another one. I said, you know, either you go home and stay home, or, you know, make up your mind what you want, because I can't handle
you know, your wife down here on my doorstep, you know, wanting you to come home at night. And I don't know whether that gave him the reason to do what he'd been wanting to do or what, but they separated and started divorce proceedings. And he moved back with his mother in Hot Springs and stayed with her and his father for a while. And then we ended up living together because that was too much of a drive between Covington and Hot Springs. So he just moved in with us, with me and the two girls. And needless to say, if Walt thinks they had a time, we did too, because my ex-husband was in town. Well, my soon-to-be ex-husband was in town. His wife was in town. And all they did was ride up and down the street to see which one of us was there. I tell you. And it was hell, because I was scared to death that she was going to kill me or him. And that my old man was going to kill me or him. That if he got any more evidence on me, he'd take my children. And I was scared. I mean, it wasn't funny, really. I was scared to death. And I just kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And I say, he was drinking all the time, but I never saw anything wrong with this. My mother to this day says, couldn't you see it was the drinking? And I go, no, obviously it was a drinker. I just didn't see it. I thought they were nice guys, and as soon as I married them, I could love them enough to straighten them out. Because that's all a drunk ever needed was one good woman that loved him. And that's what I was going to do. I was going to straighten out mankind one by one. Straighten them out. I really belong here, don't I? No question. Well, we finally got our messy divorces straightened up. Oh, boy. And got married. And I really love him. I'm still married to him today. And I love that man more than I've ever loved anybody in my life. He is really a very special type of person. And it was so hairy in Covington with all these ex-husbands and wives running around that we moved to Roanoke 7 years ago. And he went into the real estate business. And we thought, you know, we'd have somewhere to start all over again with these two little girls that he dearly loved. And I guess that's one of the things that always made me know how special that man was, because he loved them just as if they were his own. There was never any question about leaving the kids with mother. I was a package deal, you know. It was all of us or none. And that's the way he took us. And he adopted them after we had been married for a while. And this was the one thing that I didn't make him do. And I was always so grateful, because he wanted them to really be his. And he has been the daddy that they didn't have, because when my first husband divorced, my youngest one was a year and a half old and Robin was three, so they really did not know him that much. And he left town, he left the state, he left the country. I think he just moving once he got away from me, and I don't blame him. To this day I can see where he was probably relieved to get away from it. So here we were in Roanoke, and we set up housekeeping, and at that time he was more periodic drinker than a day-to-day drinker. He would pull binges, you know. And we were very happy, and we decided since we were so happy we'd have a baby. And again, because I needed somebody to love me, I thought this is what you did to make that love complete, is you had a baby. So we have a third little girl who is a real special little kid. She really is. She put a penny in my underwear for luck in my suitcase before I left. She's 5 years old, and she's really been a sunshine in my life a lot of times. Of course, with alcoholism, you know, it grew progressively worse. He drank more, and I screamed more
and got sick. And, you know, we tried a lot of things. We tried moving. We tried buying a lot of things. We eventually moved to Floyd in Floyd County, Virginia, which is about 50 miles from Roanoke. Bought a farm. I mean a big farm. You know, we went big. And cows and tractors and pickup trucks, you know, and I thought this was what would make this man happy. That if he had all these things that he wanted, that he wouldn't have to drink. And so we moved down there, and that's where it really got bad. Because for the next 2 years, I never saw him sober up. He got drunk the weekend we moved in, and I remember standing in the hall saying, "You could have waited till you got the curtain rods up." Yeah, I said that. Oh. I said everything. If you loved me, you would quit. Don't you see what you're doing? Don't you love us enough? You know, over and over. What is it about me that makes you drink? Why do you hate us? You know, all of this that I just wanted so bad to know what it was that hurt him so bad that he had to drink and cover it up. But we really had a long, slow sink into alcoholism when we moved out to this farm. I was cut off from everybody, and I have never had any friends. I know a lot of people now and I talk about how they told everybody what he did. I never told a living soul. I never told my mother, my father, my sister. They were so surprised when I told them he was alcoholic. They were amazed because I had kept everything. I had no friends. I went out one time a week to the grocery store and I wrote a bad check. And then I went home and waited for the bad check to come back and they'd call me. And that's the way I lived for about a year and a half. I also cleaned my house day and night. That was like my little world, and I stayed there. I scrubbed bathrooms until, you know, I had gotten so paranoid that if you went and used the bathroom, I was just full of resentment because I had to clean it again. That's just how I lived. You know, soap bubbles blew my mind. I had to... But that's the way I had gotten. I could not function outside. I couldn't be with people. It scared me to death to think that somebody would come and see us like we were. I remember about Christmas, it finally hit me how bad a shape he was in when I had gone Christmas shopping. And I came in and the baby was on the porch naked in the rain and he didn't know where the other two were. And I knew right then I couldn't leave my children with him anymore. He was that bad because he would pass out anytime, anywhere. He's the kind of drunk that I said when he hit the door, he hit the floor. You know? You know, and that was it. He didn't drink in bars. He didn't like anything social. And see, this is a complete opposite from my first husband. He loved the Moose Lodge, you know, and fast cars and faster women. And I was just determined if I got married again, it would be somebody who liked staying home. Well, that's really exactly what I got because my husband drank in his truck. He was a parking lot drunk. You didn't see him drink. I never, never saw him drink. I found empty pints everywhere. That's what he carried was pints. He drank straight liquor and drank it straight out of the pint. And he told me later that he was up to 4 and 5 pints a day at one point. And I didn't know that because, see, I never saw him drink. He drank before he got home, and then that's when he hit the floor. So I never saw, you know, what he did. But it was a miserable, miserable life back then. It really was. And it was sad because what I did after a point, when I saw I couldn't do anything for him or about him, I started taking it out on the kids. And I neglected them, and I abused them, and I left them. And I suffered more guilt about what I did to my children than really I did about the alcoholic, because I really did a lot of things that hurt them. They never knew what I was going to do. If they spilled their milk, I became a witch, screaming and slapping, and honestly acted worse than he did because he was usually quietly asleep somewhere, and I was screaming and going crazy. And it was in Floyd that I finally thought to myself, I just can't stand this anymore. I'm 27 years old. I've got 3 children, and I feel like I'm dying, and I can't stand it. And I thought, well, as soon as school is out, I'm going to take these kids, and I'm going to leave, and I'm going to go home, and I'm going to start all over again. Oh, boy. And that's what I had made up my mind to do. And see, I was going to wait. This shows you how insane I was at that time. I was going to wait till school was out and pack everything up and take the children away because I didn't want to upset them by pulling them out of school. But like moving them, you know, 150 miles wouldn't upset them. You know, I didn't see that. But I wanted them to finish the school year. You know, that's all I could think of, you know. Well, I don't know what happened in Floyd to me or what made me pick up the phone. I know, well, let me back up just a minute. I tried the VA, since my husband was in Vietnam, he's a veteran. And I tried the VA, and I talked to several psychiatrists down there. I'd love to see their notes on me, you know, because I told them for 45 minutes, you know, what his problems were, why he was drinking. Something happened in Vietnam that turned this man into an alcoholic, something, you know. And I tried to get him into VA. There is one in Salem, which is right outside of Roanoke. And they do have an alcoholic program. They call it the Salem program. And so I was, but see, I didn't think he was an alcoholic. I thought he was crazy. Because he did these crazy things, you know. So I didn't even consider the alcoholic unit. I wanted him in that house, you know. So I was on the phone to the psychiatrist, you know, and telling him all this stuff. And he said, well, bring him down here, we'll make an appointment, and, you know, we'll talk to him about his drinking, about all this stuff, you know. And I said, okay, so I approached him about it. I want you to go to the VA and talk to a psychiatrist. And he said, no, I'm not going. And I said, why not? It would help. And he said, because they keep records on you. And I said, oh, they do not. He said, they'll follow me the rest of my life. I can't get a job. I can't do anything because these records they'll keep on me. I said, no, that's not so. I've never heard of them. He says, they're secret records. So he'd go to VA. And it was a while after that. And like I say, I don't know except that it was God. I started looking through the Yellow Pages, and under alcoholism, I saw AA and Al-Anon and several other things at home. And I called AA, and I got no answer, and I called Al-Anon, and this beautiful lady answered the phone, and she was so friendly. And I cried and told her all this stuff that I had been saving off and on for 12 years that I had never told a living soul. And I told her all about it, you know. And I'll never forget what she said. She said, Juanita, we can't do a thing in the world for him, but I believe we could help you. Can I send you some literature? And I said, for God's sake, just send me anything. I'll do anything. So she got a big pack of literature together and sent it to me, and I got it a while later. And I guess that's where it really got a hold of me because I was up in Floyd. I had no family, no friends. And I was at the end of my rope, and I sat down and I read every bit of that literature. I cried all the way through it, especially the merry-go-round. And I feel to this day that's my favorite piece. If you don't read nothing in that you identify with, I don't think you've got any problem. That's just my opinion. I don't mean to explain the literature to you, but for the first time in my life, I knew what was wrong. I finally knew that it was alcoholism. He wasn't crazy. He wasn't cruel and mean and despisable. He was sick. And I didn't know nothing else, but I knew it was alcoholism. And I was up there in a little corner in the basement reading that stuff and crying. And all this stuff just started just coming into me. And I know so many people I've heard talk about having trouble accepting the disease, being insane. I didn't have a bit. Because when I read that literature, it was like you'd followed me around for 12 years and wrote down everything I did and said. And I was just, I guess it broke down the last defenses that I had had to keep from doing anything. So I got in my pickup truck and drove into Roanoke scared to death. He didn't know I was going. I lied about where I was going for a while till he caught me one day. And I wasn't where I said I was going. And I passed him. And boy, if you could have seen the look on his face, I knew, oh boy, I'll have to tell. So I told him in a restaurant. I was afraid to tell him in private. I knew he couldn't kill me in the restaurant, you know. He couldn't kill me in the restaurant, you know. But anyway, I drove into Roanoke. And I sat out there in that truck, and I was too afraid to go in. And it hit me, and I never forgot this either. It was like, girl, you drove all the way down here. Won't you at least go in there and give it a try, you know? So I got out of the truck and went in. And then the next thing that hit me was as I was in the wrong place, because they were laughing and having fun. And I didn't think there was any way you could laugh if you lived with an alcoholic. But I went on in, and the girl that had talked to me on the phone recognized me and asked me if I was wanted, and I said, yeah. And so she started talking to me. And I know a lot of people at home don't believe this, but I didn't say nothing for a long time because I had so much in me. I was afraid if I said anything, I would cry so hard. And I know they asked me, do you have any questions? You know. And the other thing I remember about my first meeting was when we stood up to say the Lord's Prayer, and the people on each side of me reached for my hand. It scared me that they were going to touch me. That's how bad I was. And I didn't know the words to the Lord's Prayer. And I was humiliated. I thought, you know, listen to so many people speak. It ought to be a requirement for membership in this program that you come from a good Christian home, don't you think? Because I did. All of us did. I don't mean to make a general statement like that because that's not fair. But it really could be a requirement for membership is to have good Christian home and good Christian parents because I did. And I didn't know the words to the Lord's Prayer. I had gotten that far away from God, from anything to do with the church. I had no hope, and I sure didn't think God was going to help me. I was convinced of that. And so you're looking at a dyed-in-the-wool, fighting agnostic, because I didn't want to hear nothing about God. And you can keep all of that stuff for your soapboxes, you know. I just didn't want to hear. Everything else anybody told me was wonderful, and I needed everything I heard, and I loved the group. And they told me there was another meeting on Wednesday morning, and I started going to that one. And somebody else told me I ought to go to an open AA meeting, and I started going to that. And I was driving in from Floyd 100 miles three times a week. That's round trip to meetings. And to this day, when somebody says they have a hard time getting a meeting, I don't believe it. I just don't believe it. Because I come at night. I come when I was told not to come back if I went, you know, and on and on and on. But I knew that there was nowhere else in the world for me, that I had to go. I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew I was going. And so I started praying, God, if you will please get us back to Roanoke, I'll be at a meeting every time they open the door. Please help me to get back because I don't know if I can do it out here by myself. And, you know, we managed to sell that farm in about 9 months and moved back to Salem, which is a little suburb of Roanoke. But in Salem, they would like if I said that, but it's a little town outside of Roanoke. But we moved back there, and that's one bargain I made with God that I have never backed down from. That's the only one I ever made Him, that if you just get me back, I promise I'll go, because I have been ever since then. And the more I go, the more good it does me. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. He was still drinking when we came back to Roanoke and really didn't want to come back. But it was like God took over, and he really couldn't stop the things that happened. I still had such a time believing in God
believing in a higher power. For a long time, the group was my higher power. Until right before, well, it was a while. I really jumped ahead of myself. I was back in Floyd, and I remember one Sunday morning, I went out to get in the truck, and I was coming to Roanoke. And I had really come to my end, I guess. And I sat there in the truck, and I said, if you're really God, and if you can do anything, please help me, because I can't stand this anymore. I just can't live. And, you know, from that minute on, he's changed my life. I didn't even know what I said that day. I really didn't know. I took the first three steps out of sheer desperation. Really. I didn't have any idea what they meant. I just took them. You know, and months later, I realized what had happened. But that minute, something greater than myself started working in my life. And the way I was and the way I am now just shows me the miracle of this program, because the thing that I fought the most and resented the most, this God stuff, is the thing that means everything in the world to me right now. Everything. That's all I care about in this life, in the program. It's everything in the world to me. Is the spiritual side of this program, because I see how it's beginning to change my life. So it really hit me hard and fast, I guess. But I'm lucky, because I was so messed up, I don't know what would have happened to me if it hadn't. I really had to hang on with both hands. So we moved back to Roanoke, and I remember they told me at meetings, it's going to get worse before it gets better. A knife through your heart. Oh, I thought, how could you say that? You know, you don't know what I live with. But you know, folks, it got worse before it got better. And that was one of the hardest things for me to accept, was people tell me it's going to get worse before it gets better. And I kept hanging on to meetings and hanging on to the phone. And one thing that really helped me was anytime I heard anybody say anything about prayer or meditation or how they did anything, you know, concerning that area, I did it. I didn't know how they did it or why they did it. I just did it. And that really kept my sanity, because I just constantly had this battle inside of me. And the only thing that gave me any peace was using any kind of suggestion that I heard from anybody in the program, in AA too, because I went to a lot of AA meetings, and boy, I'm grateful they have open AA meetings. I know about y'all, but I could love somebody else's drunk up there on the podium when I didn't love mine, you know, when I hated the thoughts of going home to him, you know, but I could love that other fella. And that's when it started for me, was the compassion started coming back. And I never stop being grateful for open AA meetings. It did me a world of good to go up there and hear them share their stories. And I guess one of the things I'm grateful for, I came into this program knowing that that man would never get sober. And so I left him alone. I really did. I just had this feeling in my heart that there was nothing that would get him sober. And for a long time he didn't. And that didn't stop me from coming, because I had found this program was for me. That I could go home and live with an alcoholic, drinking or not, and find the serenity that the program offers. I got a sponsor, and I did the very first honest thing in my entire life. I took an inventory. Oh boy, that was really hard for a pathological liar. Because I lied when I didn't have to, I lied when I didn't want to, and I lied when telling the truth would have frankly been better. But I couldn't stop lying and being a phony. And that was the very first honest thing I ever did in my life, was write all of these things down in my life and go to someone and talk to them about it. And she's a real great lady. Because after I had finished, she looked at me and said, I love you just like you are. Let's go eat some dinner. And that was the most wonderful thing that anybody had ever done for me, because I figured once I was finished, she'd probably just throw up. You know? I felt that miserable. I felt that disgusted about the things I had done. I really didn't think you could hear me and then talk about eating. I really didn't. But she loved me, and I remember sitting at her home, and she and her husband both were in the program, been in a long time. And the things that I learned from them gave me courage to keep going home. It really did. And the telephone therapy was so great for me. And, you know, I guess it was about the first of this year that I really started understanding what this program was about. I've been in a little over 3 years now. And the first of this year, I started understanding some of the steps and started using them and seeing what benefit they could be to me, to my life. And I know I've wanted so much to make amends to my children for the things that I have done to them. And through the steps, I found out that I could do an inventory on each one of my children. And that is, I haven't done it. I'm working on that. I first had to do an inventory on my first husband. And now I'm going to work on my three children. And see, I had thought I had covered all this in my first one. You know, I've done that. I told them all that. But I really didn't get as specific as I needed to be. So I'm going to work on the relationship with my three children, my three girls, by starting to do an inventory on each one of them. I want to make amends to my mother for the way I have felt about her all my life, because I have never liked my mother. I have never liked her. My father, like I said before, was my rock. He was all I cared about, and I never liked her. She and my grandmother both, I never liked either one of them. And I'm going to do an inventory on my mother so that I can know how to make amends, because the way the steps are in order, I don't see that I can make amends till I see what character defects cause these breakdowns in relationships with the people I care about the most in this world. So I really begin to see an inventory in a whole new way that I never knew about before. That one isn't enough for me. That it's always going to be things that I need to look about, that I need to deal with. And that this program can help me find the answers to these things. I've recently started sitting in on one of the Alateen meetings at home. And I wasn't real sure about that, because I didn't know how the kids would react to me or how I would react to them. But I wanted to try. And I remember after my first meeting, the next morning I was asking God whether he was still sure I ought to do this. And the one thing that he told me was something I heard a long time ago in Alma. He told me to go to 6 meetings before I made up my mind, whether I liked them or not. And after 6 meetings, if I didn't like them, I could stop. Well, I made my 4th one last Wednesday night. And, you know, I love those kids more every time I am around them. You know, they are teaching me instead of me being any help to them. I mean, they are just terrific. They may start out on a gripe session, but, you know, they come back around. I don't have to, you know, snap my fingers and say, you know, let's get back on the subject. They do that by themselves. And seeing them, I see part of me and part of my kids and all the potential in the world for all the people in this fellowship. And this is something that I have really become interested in. Is the children in this program, because I want to understand my children more, and I, in some way, if I can help somebody else's children, maybe I can make amends for some of the things that I did to mine. It has really been a great experience with the Alateens for me. I highly recommend it. I really do. They are some kind of special people. I guess I could go on through lunchtime telling you how much being in the program has done for me, how I have met people that have helped me so much, how being here has helped me so much, and hearing the different speakers, everybody. But I was sitting there Friday night thinking, gosh, everybody's saying what I was going to say. You know, there's not going to be anything left. They're all so good. But then I was reminded this morning that this is my story, and I can't tell it wrong because this is all I have. This is what I lived through. This is what happened. This is what it's like now. And this is what I have to share, is my experience, strength, and hope with the people in the fellowship. I would like to say, the thing that impressed me so much Friday night was when so many of you raised your hand for being at your first convention. I just think that was tremendous, so many new people here. And I think it's great to see new people coming in all the time. I mean, you're the lifeblood of this fellowship. I like a newcomer's meeting sometimes so much because it reminds me of things I forget about sometimes. But I want to close and say that if you're new and you're sitting here and you haven't heard anything from me or anything you identify with, that's all right. It really is. Because if you keep coming, you'll hear somebody somewhere that'll tell your story, that'll say to you the thing that will set you thinking, hey, that happened to me too. And if they could find help, I can too, because that's how it happened for me. And the thing that I think about so often is, if I could find help as stubborn and pig-headed and defiant as I was, that I just know that anybody who really wants it can get it, that it's something here for all of us, that we all have a special place, and we're very fortunate people when we think of the many people who are out there who are still suffering, either with active alcoholism or with the effects of alcoholism that many of us have known, that we are such fortunate people. I want to thank the convention committee for asking me up here. This has undoubtedly been the greatest day in my whole life. Well, it was the greatest. The day I turned my life and my will over to God was the greatest day in my whole life. This is definitely number two. It really is. I have enjoyed the fellowship and the food and the ice cream and the ice cream and the favors so very much. And I want to thank you all from the bottom of my heart for letting me share a little bit of time with y'all this morning, and thank God that each and every one of us are here. Thank you very much.